Chapter 4. Otherness. Flying Amber let us grill him for exactly 1 hour. Then he said he would submit a written report tomorrow and went off to rest. Namir wondered aloud how he would do that. Lying down is irrelevant in zero-G, but they never actually lie down, anyhow. Harches sort out all the legs. Having a conversation was odd, too, without a physical up and down. By convention, most people tried to stay upright, but if you didn't hang on to something, you could start to drift. Paul let himself go every which way, I suppose to demonstrate how natural the state was to an old space hand. We were in the compromise lounge, and it was cold. I told Snowbird we had to move into the dining area. She said she would come along for a little while. Namir had put a collection of ration bars in a plastic bag with a drawstring. I took a peanut butter one and passed the bag around. Snowbird bounced gently off the refrigerator and grabbed onto the dining room table with three arms.
"You were not too pleased with what Fly and Amber remembered?" she said to me.
"We could wish for more, but we'll have years. The next time it visits, we'll have plenty of questions," Paul said.
"Can you establish a radio link?" Merrill asked. "Or would it be better not to?"
"No reason not to," Namir said. He looked around with a stony expression. "It's a good thing we have nothing to hide. They're probably hearing every word we say."
"Through vacuum?" I said.
"Any Earth spook could do it. Spy could have dropped a microtransmitter in here while it was walking around. But you could be even more direct than that. Attach a sensor to the hull and have it transmit the vibrations it picks up." "I don't think that would work once the main drive starts up again," Paul said. "The vibrations would overwhelm your signal."
"Maybe so."
His expression didn't change.
"They'd have something like S2N, I said. "It's a spook program to coax out data that's buried in noise."
That brought a little smile.
"How on earth do you know about S2N?
"Haven't been on Earth since 72, I kidded him. "But you can learn a thing or two in orbit." It was an unpleasant memory. Dargo Solingen had used S2N to spy on Paul and Red and me, overhearing our whispered conferences under loud music. A day later, our secrets were headlines on Earth, and the others decided it was time for us all to die. Sort of a turning point in one's life.
"What it said about the others playing games," Dustin said, "to find out the rules? I want to know more about that."
"They might view us as contestants," I said.
"Or pieces," Namir said. "Pawns."
"Anything but rivals," Merrill said. "If they perceive us as a danger, we won't even get close to them."
I nodded.
"No matter what Spy says, we have to assume it can destroy us if it thinks we present a danger to the others."
"We ought to figure out a way to talk to its buddy," Paul said. "The speeded-up other."
"Hard to visualize a conversation," I said. 8 minutes passing for us, for every minute it experiences."
"Say something. Play a round of poker, then listen and respond," Dustin said. "Spy will always be our intermediary anyhow."
Namir nodded.
"We could do something like that. We just have to find a way to present it so it appears to give them an advantage."
"Home team," Dustin said. "We agree to go over there to talk?"
"That would be our advantage," Namir said. "Get a look inside their ship."
"Wait," I said. "We're not fighting them. It's the opposite. We want them to feel safe, cooperating with us."
Namir laughed. "Like a mouse negotiating with a python."
"She's right," Merrill said. "We can't see it as a contest. We already know what the result would be in a contest of strength or will."
"I don't know about will," Namir said. Elsa snorted. Spoken like a true man. You have balls, darling, but they're no advantage here.
There was a loud ping from the control room. Paul launched himself in that direction, somersaulting in midair and slipped through the door. I could hear him saying a few words, responding to the radio. He walked back with his gecko slippers, looking thoughtful.
Interesting coincidence. We have an invitation from Other Prime to come over for an audience with his nibs.
All of us? I asked.
Just four. You, me, and Namir, and Flying Amber.
Any danger?
Well, we'll want to be tethered down on the way over and back, in case of a course correction blip. I can fix that easily with a guideline. Once we're over there,
he shrugged,
we'll be at their mercy.
Exactly as we are here.
Paul put off the turnaround rotation, even though it probably would make little difference. He got a roll of cable and a couple of pitons, ice spikes, out of the workshop, and I went along as fetch and carry. It was the first time either of us had been outside in over 3 years. We'd all done it as a safety drill before the engine started. You wouldn't want to do it during acceleration. Like being perched on top of a rocket. One misstep, and you'd slide off and drop forever. Hammering in a piton wasn't simple in zero-G. There was nothing to hold him to the ground. So after each swing, he would rotate away from the spike. He'd foreseen this, of course, and brought along a hand drill to make a preliminary hole. I held a light for him, but looked away from it to preserve my night vision. The sky was beautiful. The stars brighter than on Earth. The Milky Way was a glowing billow across the darkness. I wished I knew the constellations well enough to tell whether they were different. Orion looked about the same. Paul pointed out where our sun was, a bright yellow star. But there were brighter ones. We had safety tethers attached to the airlock. After the piton was secured, Paul jetted across first, unreeling the guideline behind him. I followed him hand over hand, trying not to tangle the three lines. The airlock on the starfish-shaped craft was a barely visible lip. Paul drilled and hammered a piton right in front of it. He secured the guideline to give it about 3 or 4 feet of slack. If you held on to it, you could walk, after a fashion, from one airlock to the other. We returned to our own ship to relax for a few minutes and ensure we'd be going over with full air tanks and empty bladders. There was no strategy to discuss. We'd just keep our eyes and minds open. Flying Amber went over between us, moving with characteristic caution. I didn't mind going slowly. It was a long way down. When we got to the airlock lip, Paul opened the radio circuit. I heard a slight click. Before he could say anything, Spy's voice said, "Come in." Too loud and too clear. The lips parted to reveal a red glow. "Returning to the womb," I said. We went in, and the lips closed behind us. The small red light inside my helmet, an air warning, glowed green. "Is this safe to breathe?" Paul asked on the radio.
"If I wanted to kill you," Spy said, "I wouldn't have to go to this much trouble. This is exactly the same pressure and composition as you breathe over there." He stepped in out of the gloom and made a circle with one hand. "Paul, get your feet under you. I'm going to turn on some gravity." As the light increased, so did the feeling of weight. It was very feeble, though, much less than Mars.
"What kind of gravity?" Paul asked.
"Triton. About 1/12 Earth's gravity. Less than 1/3 that of Mars."
The room was organic in a mildly disgusting way. I had to take a colonoscopy before they would let me go to Mars. But they did let me watch. And the walls here looked like the inside of my large intestine then, pink and slippery. That gave me a whole new attitude toward the airlock. There was no furniture in the room, no windows except for two portholes, one on each side of the airlock lips. Not a sound.
I will introduce you to the other prime, though of course it cannot respond directly.
He touched the wall, and a dark oval appeared, like wet glass. We stepped forward.
I'm afraid I made a little noise of alarm.
It was, in a word, a monster.
A word that shouldn't be in a xenobiologist's vocabulary, but there you have it.
The creature was all chitin and claws, hard, shiny brown with yellow streaks and blobs. Six smaller claws, about the size of human arms, circled the thorax. A seventh one, twice as big, curled over the top like a scorpion's tail. A powerful, serrated vise. The biologist in me immediately wondered what was in its environment that required such armor and strength.
How big is it?
About twice human size, Spy said.
It won't hurt you, though.
Too warm out here for it to survive. It is looking at you through me and wants to say something. I will relay the message in a few minutes. I studied the creature while we waited. It looked more like a huge crab than any other terrestrial animal.
No crabs on Earth were that big, I thought, except maybe the long spindly ones that live on the bottom of the ocean, spider crabs. This guy could eat them alive.
Which, again, raises the question, why? None of our speculations about its environment, living in liquid nitrogen, considered the possibility of strong, fast predators. Of course, it couldn't react fast, which would explain the armor. Maybe our assumptions about body chemistry were wrong. Temperature chauvinism. The fact that this species is slow doesn't mean that all nitrogen-based cryogenic life forms are slow. So, that's the next question. If the environment has swift, strong predators, what did the others evolve from when a snail could run circles around them?
Well, just because they're smart doesn't mean they're at the top of the food chain. There are plenty of environments on Earth where the crown of creation would be lunch.
It would be fascinating to investigate the other's planet and see whether it was biologically as complex as Earth.
Mars never had been, or at least we've never found any fossils you could see without a magnifying glass.
Maybe the other's planet had a whole film of smaller and less complex crab-like creatures, culminating in this beautiful example.
It was beautiful, in its way.
It wants to congratulate you, Spy said, on having made it halfway. The odds are good you will continue on to Wolf 25 and arrive intact. It currently has no interest in destroying you. It reminds you of the obvious, though. This ship you are in has an autonomous intelligence that thinks faster than you can and won't hesitate to destroy you, and us, whenever that might be necessary for the protection of our home planet. You are here on our sufferance. We are curious about you and wish to study you.
Why should you let us live? Namir said. You've already tried to destroy us once. Why should we expect you will let us survive now?
Is that a question you wish me to ask Other Prime?
Yes, Namir and Paul said simultaneously.
I wasn't sure about that, and I started to say, wait.
But it was too late when my lips formed the word.
What if it said, you're right, and we were all simply doomed? It could flick us away like a speck.
Fly and Amber expressed my misgivings.
Perhaps that was not wise. We should preserve our options and not compel it to make a decision.
Now or later, Namir said. It will be easier to work with it if we know we have a chance of surviving.
It occurred to me that the room had no smell of its own. Standing next to Paul, I could smell the peanuts on his breath. But there was nothing from the ambient environment. Martian rooms had a characteristic smell like damp earth. Nothing like that here. It was like a VR background with the smell turned off. Other Prime answered in less than a minute. Probably a prepared response. The question was no surprise. That is fair. We do not think the same way as you. But let me try to put this in human terms. You averted worldwide catastrophe by moving our device to where it could not harm you. There were other things that you could have done, but that was sufficient. If you wish, you may think of that as a test that your species has passed. Contacting me here would be the second test. How many tests might be necessary for your assurance, I cannot say. The home planet does not yet know anything, of course. It will be more than a decade before my last communication from your solar system reaches them. I can say that other races have attained this degree of rapport with us, and many of them were allowed to go on their way. Some were not. None who resorted to aggression were allowed to survive. You must have deduced this already. That's all? Paul said after a few seconds. Yes. I showed you around our facilities, Flying Amber said. Will you reciprocate? Not now. I will discuss this with Other Prime. Right now, it is resting. It takes a lot of energy for it to communicate with us, I said. That is not something you need to know at this time. Be careful when you leave. There is no gravity on the other side of the airlock. Paul snorted.
Don't let the door hit you on the way out.
It will not do that, Spy said. Flying Amber nodded.
Two species, with but a single sense of humor.